Blog Talk Radio.
California, beautiful day, sunny. I hope it's nice where you're at, and you're able to enjoy the show for the next hour or so. I think I mentioned last week that a new app was available to listen to Earth Ancients on your smartphone. It's called Stitcher, S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R. And I am recommending that people use this app over iTunes for the simple reason that they have figured out a way to improve the sound quality and the reproduction of my program and many, many other programs. I think they have 25,000 podcasts around the world. And someone called me and asked me to check into it, and I have, and I downloaded it and listened to the program, and it is, it's not only is it crisp and clear, it's the app is really cool. You can download multiple programs, you can load them up so that you listen to them one after another, and you can choose to have your best of selection of apps right at your command. So after you listen to one show, you might go, oh, I want to go listen to some news, or I want to go listen to sports or a talk show. And Stitcher is a great, great tool. I have been using it now for just a couple of weeks, and I really recommend that you go out and consider it. It's an easy, free download, Stitcher.com. Put it up on your, get it up on your smartphone, go to your store, it's a free app, download it and try it. I actually like it over iTunes. I get some people letting me know that they're not a really big fan. If you're listening to it on your laptop or your desktop, sometimes you got to go through rigmaroles because they want you to update. I mean, iTunes is constantly asking you to update. They're updating the software every week. So that gets kind of old. So check out Stitcher. So I think it's a really good tool. A couple of notes on the Facebook page. On the group page, Earth Ancients Facebook, it's the blog. I put up a photograph of the interior section of the Pyramid of the Magician in Uxmal, Yucatan. And what is unique about this photo is, and I've seen a couple of these photos, is that and this was taken probably at the turn of the century. I want to say 1902 or 1904. Lori Cash, who's an archaeologist, posted it, and I have reposted it. And what's unique about this photo is when they first discovered Uxmal in the, I think it was like the early 1800s, it appeared to have been hammered by water currents or undulating water of some kind that reached almost the top of the pyramid. And when I say water, I mean, it looks like this whole area of Uxmal, which is on the Gulf side, Gulf of Mexico side of the peninsula, it appears that the whole area was covered underwater, and the significant amount of damage was done to this pyramid. And it was covered in rubble and dirt, sediment, and a good portion of the stonework was pushed off and collected in piles around the base of this pyramid. But what's interesting is the Pyramid of the Magician was built in three different sections. The first section, they speculate, was built probably about 1,500 years ago or older. Of course, this is conventional archaeology, and they're dating remains of organic material that's surrounding the pyramid or within the pyramid. And I believe it's probably significantly older, by many, many thousands of years. But this photograph shows the front panels of the pyramid, and you're not able to see this today. When I was there about 5 years ago, and I've been there like three different times, this area, this front area, is shielded from the public. You can't get in there. And it's this photograph shows these unusual shaped rings. They thought it was a depiction of an elephant's trunk, because at the far end of this photograph, there's this picture that looks like a swirled piece of stone, and it looks like an elephant trunk. But the front has these rings. And one of the things about the Mayan pyramids that John Burke discovered is that they are energetic modifiers. And what does that mean? What that means is that there was a period in the Mayan history, early proto-Maya, where they actually understood natural geomagnetic fields. And I've mentioned this a number of times. And this photograph, I believe, and I've seen part of this, I stuck my camera in and took a picture of this area in a small hole that was left open. They've covered this up for some reason. I don't know why they decided to cover this front area and not allow it the public to get in there. But I believe that these pyramids were used to transmute natural occurring geomagnetic fields, what John Burke calls telluric fields, telluric energy fields. And this photograph shows these unusual rings that are in the front of this pyramid, and then I believe at one time circled the whole exterior of the outer structure. Now, Uxmal is a unique pyramid because it's an oval-shaped pyramid. It's round. If you look at it from the satellite or look down from the sky, it has a rounded base, an oval base, that comes up to a building on the top. Three different phases, about, predictions are 1500, then again around 500 years later, a second pyramid was added, and then a final pyramid structure was added on top of the earlier pyramids. Remember, the Maya, as well as a number of older civilizations, sanctified their earlier ancestors and built, rather than tearing down, they actually built usually on top or modified the structures in some way. So take a look at this photograph. It's on the Earth Ancients group page, and it is the Pyramid of the Magician. And the other fascinating thing is you can see a picture of a small boy at the end that kind of gives a perspective of this room. And in front of him is dirt and sediment and rocks that have been pushed into there by the undulation of water. And as I mentioned, it was, this area was covered in water. As I was growing up, I was fascinated by history. My grandfather was a country doctor, a GP out in a place called San Luis Obispo, which is in Central California. He was he lived in a small town called Oceano, which is a sleepy little town a few miles south of Pismo Beach. And in the 1920s, he was the only physician in a 50-mile radius. And I think his claim to fame is, I think he delivered like 2,000 or 3,000 babies and took care of the local population. But he was fascinated by the Native Americans of America, and was just very, he was fascinated by different cultures. And when I would go to visit and stay with my grandparents, it was always an experience, because he had idols from India. He and the reason he had all this stuff, he did have a fascination, but in the 1920s, there was the Great Depression. Nobody had any money, so people bartered for services, and it was rare that my grandfather got a payment. He told me that it was rare that he got money. So, you know, he had people work on his garden. He had a couple of acre property. And it was interesting because in that part of the California region, there was a large Hispanic population, a large Chinese population, and there were also Indian from India population that settled in that area. And so people would give him fairly heirlooms. He had amazing rug collection, and the inside of his home, which he built himself, was filled with Chinese masks and carvings and Hindu things. And all these things impressed upon me as a kid and really fascinated me. But one of my things that my grandfather did, and he was a great reader, he had a small library of books that he placed in his waiting room. People came and saw him for services. He had an office, a medical office, in the front part of his home. He built it into his home. But in his waiting room, he created a library. And he had shelves filled with all kinds of books that people could read as they waited for their turn to be seen by him. And he was a great fascination with Native Americans, but he also had a fascination with the unusual phenomenon. And he had a collection of books by an author named Charles Fort. Now, if you don't know who Charles Fort is, I suggest that you do a Google search for Charles Fort, because he wrote a number of fascinating books. His most well-known is called The Book of the Damned, where he chronicles historic events that are unexplainable by science. And as an example, he talks about how it was recorded by certain Native American tribes that in one period in their history, it started raining. But it didn't rain normal water. It rained frogs. Frogs and creatures. And he also chronicles a lot of unusual types of occurrences having to do with weather patterns and having to do with historical events around the world where weather plays a huge part that in a local history where they cannot describe the weather as normal, it's very unusual, or it's not something that is typical. And Charles Fort filled his books with these phenomenon. And after a while, if you became interested in Charles Fort, you were considered a Fortean, someone who studied unusual historic events and chronicled them. My guest today is kind of a modern Charles Fort, and he has written a fascinating book called Other Worlds, where he is has chronicled ancient history, ancient myths, and a lot of phenomena left to us by ancient people that we just do not understand. Steve Peaks is my guest today, and Steve has just recently taken up writing. He has had a number of books published. He has a background as a game industry. I think he's a programmer. We'll ask him in a minute. 40-year career, which allowed him to travel extensively and explore the histories and myths of people and places. His books that you can get are Long Claws, Alien Agenda, Coyote Dreaming, and the book we'll talk about today, Other World. Hi, Steve. How are you doing today?
Hi. How are you? I'm doing great. Very interesting thing. He's talking about some interesting things there.
Well, I think your book, which we're going to talk about, brings up quite a few of these. Now, you're in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And how close are you to the a major city there? Like, what's the major city you're closest to?
Probably Greensboro, which was about 60, 65 miles away.
Okay. So you're pretty far. You're kind of out there in the country, is what you would
say. In the country, yeah. I got moved here because I retired and couldn't afford to stay in San Francisco. And I looked for a place that was financially friendly for retirees, and I wound up here. When I was a kid, my dad was career military and stationed in Washington and Arlington and Pentagon a good bit. And we used to, in the summers, come over to the mountains and camp. And I just like these mountains. It's just a great area. It's wooded, and I love it.
Fantastic. Yeah. I've driven through some of those areas. It's really beautiful. It's very, very scenic.
Yeah, there's some very, very secluded places.
Mm-hmm. So do you grow your own food out there?
Tried it. I'm going to try again. The first year I moved here, I did, you know, bought all the books and internet things on how to grow your garden and when to plant what, how to do your own organic insecticide and so forth. And first that spring of 2013, this area of the country where I was had 5 times its annual rainfall in April and May.
Wow.
So all the vegetables grew to be huge things that were totally unedible.
Oh, they got too big, yeah.
Got too big, yeah, too much water.
Mm.
So I thought I would wait a while. Now I'm getting ready to start another one. But the first time, you know, I just planted everything. This time I'm only going to plant what I normally eat.
Okay. Amazing. Hey, this book you wrote is really a fun read, Other Worlds.
Yes, sir.
It's like you are a modern day Charles Fort. And was that your intention to kind of follow in his footsteps?
No, not at all. I mean, I certainly admire Charles Fort, and I'm flattered that you would say I'm a modern day Charles Fort. But Charles Fort, as you, I'm sure, know, was a very wealthy man. And this is what he spent his life doing, this collection of the odd and the strange. as was he was kind of the pre Robert Ripley of, you know, collecting, as you said, strange, you know, and unusual things. Mm-hmm. And once you start reading his books, a lot of people start saying, well, this is too dry, this is, you know, not exciting writing the way it's written. But the information is so compelling that you could, I certainly would say that if I hadn't read Charles Fort, I probably would have never gotten interested enough in these things to write Otherworld.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a huge amount of research, as you can see, involved.
This is what, your research is just phenomenal. We're going to touch on a few chapters, just too much to bring up in the short time that we have, but let's get right into it here. You start off in the early parts of the book talking about ancient monsters, and in your chapter, A Brief History of Monsters, you describe what I didn't realize was the phenomenon of dragons and the worldwide myths. Now, apparently you discovered that giants are mentioned in very ancient texts, including the Hindu Rig Veda, Vedas.
Yes.
How did you tell us about that? And does it? It's almost like they appear to be real creatures.
Well, the premise of the book, when you get to the end of it, is not that it would ruin it for anyone, because you kind of figure it out as you're reading, is that these creatures, including the dragon, were real. But they weren't of this world, Earth. They were from the other world. And there are multiple other worlds. And today's quantum physics is laid out, not just today. I mean, it started with Einstein and Max Baird, Planck, and all of them. When they started investigating quantum physics, Einstein called it spooky science, because and the subatomic particles do not behave as they should based on Newtonian physics. So they act totally differently. And several experiments that I won't bore anybody with right now, but experiments as far back as the 20s and 30s, and now more sophisticated experiments with CERN and SLAC and some of the other atom smashers, indicate that our world is not alone. And I'm not talking about aliens from another planet, you know, 400,000 light years away. I'm talking about just a vibration away in the atomic structure. For instance, and these things, what I'm saying now is proven. It's not theory anymore. When you look at an atom, and I know I'm taking a long way around, and I will get to your dragons in a minute, but you have to kind of understand this.
Yeah,
you have
yeah,
to kind of understand
ahead.
This to accept it. And as I said, these are experiments that have proven this and been replicated, duplicated in various places. So this is real. If you look at an atom where you can actually see it, it's not like what you saw on your on the chart in your high school science class. It doesn't look like a solar system, okay? You have the nucleus, and to give you an example of how this works, let's say that the nucleus is blown up an enormous time, billion times, and is now as big as a BB. And if you put that BB on the end zone line of a football field, the closest electron or neutron that orbits that BB, the nucleus, would be on the other end of the football field and would be completely invisible to the naked eye. So what you have is that when an atom with all of its subparticles is 99.9777 some ridiculous number of decimals empty space. Mm-hmm. So let that sink in a minute. Atoms make up molecules. Molecules, somehow, anything from molecular structure up, forms solid matter. But if you were just building things based on atoms, nothing would exist. Does that make sense?
So far, yeah.
Okay. So, now, when you look at these subatomic particles, they flash in and out. They don't exist full time. And what they do is they flash out in, let's just say, the northeast of the nucleus, and when they flash back in, they're on the south of the nucleus. And then they flash again, and this flashing is supposedly a vibration. And so understanding this led physicists to ask the question, well, if they don't exist for some amount of time, where are they? And that led to the predictions of other worlds or parallel dimensions. And so these parallel worlds, if a billion galaxies exist in what we can see from our little planet, then there's even more parallel universes than those. And in some of those parallel universes, creatures exist. And something in our far past, something on certain times and certain events allowed some of those creatures to cross into our world from one or another dimension, and sometimes it let humans cross into their worlds.
Well, that's interesting, because that's the basis of your book, is that the ancients knew of these other worlds.
Yeah.
And some of them were sharp enough to figure out how to go between our world and the other worlds, which I find is fascinating. So what you're saying is that some of these creatures bled through or were able to cross over into our reality.
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And interesting, you led, when you opened your show, you spoke about magnetic fields and magnetic fluctuations, or electromagnetic. There's a difference. The electric magnetic field of the Earth is very subtle, except when certain events occur, and then it can be very, very terrific. It's very subtle, and we actually know very little about it. It is in the league of gravity. We know it's there. We know it works. But sometimes our models of it, we just don't know enough about it. And electromagnetic fields is what I believe opened and closed these doorways during certain events. An event might be a volcano eruption. An earthquake, a violent lightning storm, an eclipse, a lunar eclipse, and sometimes just lunar alignment affects the Earth's magnetic field. And in the old days, when you look at Stonehenge, one of the most prominent theories is that it was built as a calendar, and I think it was more than that. I don't think somebody would have, spent 200 generations building a calendar if they already knew that. I think it was something else. But it was a calendar, and the importance of the calendar was to measure when these fluctuations occurred so that you could be on the lookout for either things coming in or you going out. And Stonehenge, and the newest theory of Stonehenge is that basically it was nothing but pylons, and there was a platform on top of it for entertainment. But if you've ever been there, in order to see a platform on top of it, you would have to be so far away that you couldn't see what was going on. So yeah. I don't know.
Let's jump into this because we're going to cover Stonehenge as part of my interest in this our conversation here today.
Sure.
But let's talk about dragons, because I have a fascination with dragons, and so you're saying that through these portals, these energetic portals, these creatures may have been real, is what you've discovered.
Well, let's look at types of myths that exist. Mm-hmm. There are things that are obvious that people would have had sun gods and rain gods and moon gods, because that happens all over the world. So those are what's called universal myths. A myth about a flood might be a regional myth, right? So it doesn't occur everywhere. So dragons fall into the category of universal myths. In other words, cultures separated by 10,000 years and halfway around the world came up with the same, almost exact creature that would appear and hang around for a while and then be slain or disappear. So if every culture on the earth throughout the existence of human people had a belief about dragons, you have to believe something was there. And they're not always called dragons in different languages and so forth. But, the descriptions and their actions can be very similar. And when you get into the Asian dragons, you have the same type of dragons, which the European dragons. But some of the dragons in Asian lore were actually helpful, not destructive.
Yeah.
So that's why I believe dragons were or are real. That, we just don't have any on our earth this time.
It's amazing because you actually track dragons to Central America, and appear to be in Mexico. Of course, they're different. They're called different names, but
right.
a description of their bodies and their great size is amazing. And can you talk a little bit about what the Mexicans
Well, the Mexicans had the winged serpent, which was essentially a flying snake. But as you get into it and you look at the depictions, those snakes, while depicted as a snake with wings, they also had legs with taloned feet. And there was a story of one that was helpful to the Incas, but it had to leave for some mythological reason, a part of the story. And it left, and it headed east over the ocean, but he said he'd be back, and so there was a lot of anticipation for this thing coming back, but apparently it never did.
it's funny because you opened the program describing these vortexes, and that's the only thing we can call them is these otherworld vortexes. So when the energy is at a certain peak or a vibrational rate or whatever, because we don't understand what it is, these vortexes open and these creatures come into our reality.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
A number of things have happened since these myths originated. One is that the magnetic pole of the Earth has shifted 40 or 50 times, flopped, not the whole planet turned over, but the magnetic poles have moved. You with me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we know this because of lava in the ocean that has volcanoes that are still today continuing to push lava out. And as you measure various places in the lava field, the magnetic field was captured, almost a photograph of it, in various areas of the lava, so that you can take this piece of this stretch of lava and say, okay, at this time, north was to the top of our planet, or the magnetic polar cap was to the north of our planet. At this time, it was to the north, east, or the east. So that has moved a lot, which would have impacted pretty dramatically the alignment of various dimensions. It might have changed it so that dragons were here in one effect of that, but not in another, and something else was here. Talk away. So these, I forgot what I was going to say.
Yeah, these creatures must have some form of intelligence. In your chapter on land monsters, you discuss a creature that is seen quite readily, but has a very elusive ability, and that's the Sasquatch.
Sure.
And it's funny because there are people who've spent their entire lives looking after the Sasquatch, which is a physical being that is a makeup of humanoid and some other creature, and is of immense size and weight, and yet no one has really taken a good photograph of these beings because they seem to disappear. And it seems to be in your book, you're saying that these might be a creature who can go through these vortexes quickly and have an ability and understand the electromagnetics of our planet and manipulate them with quite a bit of ease. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. When I was 1971, I was stationed in Tacoma, Washington, and myself and a couple of other guys went to the base recreation place, rented, signed out some tents and camping gear, and we went and we drove as far up as we could, and we got to Spirit Lake on Mount St. Helens, obviously before the famous eruption. And then we drove up the mountain to a place that was known as Ape Canyon. And Ape Canyon started when we were 10,000 feet high, and Ape Canyon started as just a crack in the ground and very quickly widened to a very deep gorge. I would say it's 100, 200 feet deep at places, with straight sheer rock walls. And on the right of it, there had been a lumber camp, 100 years before we went. And the story was, the reason it was called Ape Canyon was that lumberjacks, the lumbermen that worked up in these wooden log cabins, were built on this plateau, which on one side of it was the 200-foot drop down Ape Canyon, and on the other side of it was a sheer cliff going up about 200 feet. And these guys, every time they came down to town, would tell stories about seeing the apes, which, essentially are the Sasquatches. And one of the things I wanted to see, because I read the story about it, in kind of a dubious pulp publication, and I thought, well, as long as I'm here, I might as well go up and see this. So we drove up there, and back in those days, the interest in Bigfoot was nothing like it is today. There were really no TV shows about it or anything. But anyway, we drove up to Ape Canyon, and we had to get out and walk because the plateau between the down cliff and the up cliff got too rocky and too rough and too narrow to drive. So we walked, carried our tents and everything. And sure enough, we found the ruins of these cabins. Now, the story was that one of the apes had gotten kind of friendly, or not friendly, that sounds, had become used to one of the lumberjacks. And it would not run away from it. It certainly was not domesticated. But anyway, so the lumberjack would leave food out for it and watch it, and it would come get the food and eat. And then another lumberjack was hiding behind a tree when this happened and shot the Sasquatch, which wasn't dead, but it crawled away and then fell over the downward cliff into the gorge and got into the river, and nobody ever found the body or whatever. But that night, boulders were rolled off the upward cliff down on the cabin roofs and crashed through the roofs and destroyed the buildings. And when you go up there, or when you could go up there before the eruption, those boulders, which were too big for a car to pull away, you know, they had been rolled somehow, were inside these cabins where in the floors were ruined, you know, where it had cratered through the roof and then into the floor.
Yeah.
And so you're talking to a believer in the Bigfoot.
You saw it firsthand.
I didn't see a Bigfoot, but I saw that, and that was enough to convince me something had caused that to happen, because the boulders weren't all along the length of the upward cliff. They were only clustered around where the cabins were.
So somebody had to move them.
Yeah, somebody had to move them. Somebody big had to move them. And yes, I think that Bigfoot probably have some kind of ability to move dimensionally. And I don't know if it's they have the sense for where the vortexes are, but they certainly seem to be so elusive that you can't photograph them. The other thing is that if they're actually in a vortex, the electromagnetic field probably would disturb the photography.
I was wondering about that, if that's one of the reasons we don't have any decent photographs.
Yeah, it may be. I mean, you know, and I think in the book I also talk about lake monsters, and it may be kind of the same thing with them, that Loch Ness and Champ and some of these others go in and out of vortexes. When you look at these vortexes and how these animals sensed it, and I believe humans at one time could sense them to a certain extent. In a perfect example of animals reacting to the electronic field are homing pigeons, bees, honeybees, any kind of migrating bird or butterfly, insect. They all, and the whales are another example, whales, porpoises, and sharks. All of them navigate based on electromagnetic fields. And if you ever went to the aquarium in Baltimore, Maryland, which was a very interesting aquarium in that where you were was you were in a spiral walkway going up, and the inside diameter of the walkway was probably 100 feet. And so on your left in a giant tube and on your right in a double tube was the aquarium, the ocean with the creatures in it. Mm-hmm. And so there was one shark that was in this one area, one depth of the aquarium. And every time it would make the circle around the outside, it would come to a place and it would bump its nose on the wall. And then it would kind of shake it off and go around again and come back and bump its nose in the same place. And so the aquarium curators were trying to figure out, well, why? What's going on? And they finally discovered that on the outside wall where the shark was bumping its nose, there was a wire with a short in it that was disturbing the electromagnetic field.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
Kind of interesting. Let's keep going on this electromagnetics. You have a tremendous amount of content on the natural occurring energy grids of the Earth, and you touched upon the Stonehenge, and I'd like you to talk to our audience about your chapter on the megalithic computer, which is, in your estimation, the Stonehenge. And you discovered the writings of Professor Gerald Hawkins and what he had unveiled, which I'd never heard of Hawkins before. Can you tell us a little bit about what he uncovered about the workings of Stonehenge?
You're going to have to refresh my mind. There were quite a few people. What did Hawkins think?
Well, Hawkins apparently showed that there was a grid.
You have to remember, I wrote this book about 30 years ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, it's a natural grid, and that it not only is...
Oh, the ley lines.
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
the
sure. The ley lines are electromagnetic lines in the magnetic field that are fairly constant. For example, animals that are migratory, that from year to year move up and down, would use these lines to follow place to go to places where they knew there was water or they knew there was food or whatever. Bees use these lines when they go out of the hive and they discover a flower of interest and they come back and then they do the little dance and the other bees go to where the flowers are. But an interesting thing is that while they're gone, if you move the hive about 30 feet away to the left or the right, not on the line, the bees come back and hover where it used to be. And sometimes they find it and sometimes they don't. And these ley lines cross, is a net around the entire planet. And if you, there are certain places where you can take Stonehenge, Newgrange in Ireland, Karnak in France, and many, many, many of these megalithic structures were built unknown to the people who built them. Because they were in different countries, you know, separated by oceans, without, you know, this is before they had cell phones. Were built in a line, a straight line. People who, I had some very, very rural country relatives, and one of them was what's called a dowser or a diviner. And he was very much into this, not from a intellectual interest, but from an interest of understanding how to use them. And he could not only find water using a ley line, he could use that ley line then to go another direction perpendicular to it and tell you how deep you would have to dig to get to the water.
Wow.
And some people have the ability, more than others, to sense these fields. University of Minnesota did a study probably 25 years ago, where they had students go out and douse for things that were buried in the snow. And the professor that conducted the study happened to believe in ley lines, and he found one, and he put the stuff around the ley line. And his conclusion was that about 80% of the human beings, have some small level of feeling that magnetic field. I think that we, who used to be hunter-gatherers, could feel it, could sense it. I mean, how important would it be for you to know where water was or where water was not or where mountains were? Because the magnetic fields in mountains, which are essentially piles of stone, and stones carry quartz, would affect it, would make it stronger. I think humans, when we were migratory, could sense the magnetic field much better than we can today. I think once we became domesticated and weren't nomadic anymore, we didn't need that talent, and we just kind of let it atrophy.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so that's kind of the European ley lines. In China, I believe they call them Lung Mei lines, which is the, interestingly enough, the path of the dragon, or the dragon's path, and these lines run perfectly straight for hundreds of miles. In Peru, is it Peru where we have the Nazanut lines?
Yeah, it's in Peru.
Yeah. And what you see are these earth workings that are hundreds of miles apart, yet they are perfectly straight. Just to me, that's incredible.
Well, you actually also bring up another interesting thing that really piqued my interest, is that you believe that the Maya used and built these, they call them the white roads, that go on for hundreds of miles in many, many directions, and you believe those could have been magnetic.
Absolutely. Yeah, they...
Which I
go ahead.
I just find that fascinating, because I never even considered that those would be based on a magnetic current. But it makes sense, because we now know that the Maya built their pyramids on top of big geomagnetic fields, geomagnetic bursts.
Anomalies where the Earth's magnetic field is somehow altered. And one of the greatest anomalies on Earth is the Bermuda Triangle, oddly enough. Another thing in the book, though, is that these ley lines, where they crossed, created points of double power or triple power, depending on how many crossed there. Stonehenge has, I think, 4 or 5 ley lines that basically, for lack of a better word, magnifies the force when it arrives there. As anybody who studies Stonehenge will know, that the trilithons, the largest stones in the center, came from the Preseli Mountains in Wales. And the Preseli Mountains in Wales, they're sometimes called the Blue Stones. Those stones have enormous magnetic effect, that they could actually bend a magnetic field toward them. And some people say, they say it's even still true today, that on some nights when it's thunderstorms and so forth, or very, very cloudy, you can actually see parts of the peaks of those mountains where the rocks are exposed glowing, which is freaky.
But, you know, it's interesting that you talk quite a bit about Stonehenge. Is it your feeling that it might be one of these... a vortex, maybe a traveling device to go to these other dimensions?
Yeah, I do. And I think that, I'm not sure what I think about why all of these things were built. I think, you know, for instance, Stonehenge and Newgrange, which are two of the most elaborate, and you have to remember, there are 4,000 megalithic structures in England, and half that many in Ireland, and half that many in Scotland. They're all over Europe. They go through India and Persia and China. They exist everywhere in America. And I think that the more complex ones, like Stonehenge and Newgrange, were probably places that were built to allow you, a human, to move through to the other side or the other world. I think maybe the pyramids, the Egyptian pyramids and the Mayan pyramids, may have some of that. But I also think that there were a lot of these megalithic sites that were built along these ley lines, not for the purpose of us crossing into another dimension, but for the purpose of keeping things in the other dimensions from crossing here. In other words, shutting the door to our world. Because how many times would you like for a dragon to come visit your village?
Yeah, there's a lot of movies about dragons destroying villages. I think the latest Hobbit movie had a dragon working.
I'm sorry, I lost you.
The latest Hobbit movie had a big dragon in it that had to be dispatched. So dragons are in our consciousness. It's very interesting.
Yes, yeah, they are. And there are many, many works, a lot by psychologists and psychiatrists, who say that dragons are nothing but myth. They never were, and it was stories to test, to make us afraid and to test our fears. Well, I don't know that I think they probably did make us afraid, and I think they probably did test our fears, but I think that we probably had a few over here. And I don't think it would take very many to show up in Europe and that spread and become a regional myth pretty quickly. Go ahead. One of the places in England, near a little town called Glastonbury, which is a fascinating city. If you ever want to read some interesting history of a little town, but it's really fascinating. But one of the things near there is what's called the Tor, the T-O-R, which is a mound of earth, which in America and in Mexico we call them barrows. And in many, many barrows, there would be places where you would excavate them and you would find an area where there were, you know, several, 200 or 300 people's bones were buried in there. It wasn't like a pyramid or a king's burial place, but it was people buried in there. And barrows sometimes are built and either lined with or centered with quartz material, which supposedly alters the ley line or the magnetic field going through it. But on the top of the Tor, there's a tower, which is called St. Michael's Tower. It's very simple, but it's shaped like a sword hilt. And the legend is that the last dragon in England, was killed by St. Michael, and that's where it's buried. That's his tomb. And the tower represents the hilt of the sword that killed it.
Fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about Earth Force, which is the in your chapter on energy machine? This gentleman, a British archaeologist, Guy Underwood, he found really the Earth energy grid, and I guess those are the ley lines. But
the grid is the ley lines. But
yeah,
yeah. Go ahead.
But I mean, they go all the way to the Americas, and I'm not sure they've really been plotted except in the East Coast, out where you are. But there's grids all over the place, and I think more and more of them are being identified around the world.
Yeah, there are. And I think we knew more about them 300 years ago, as far as just individuals, than we know now. For whatever reason, there was an English preacher, minister, a French priest, Chinese monk, that we had this area in about the middle to the end of the 1800s where religious people went around and tore down many of these places that created this linear, these linear megaliths along the ley lines. and in his book, he calls it Earth. I think he refers to them as Earth fingers, where these stones are standing straight up. That they are in a place where they tap into that ley line or that energy, the Earth energy, and pull it out. But essentially, I think he's calling it Earth energy because up until the 1980s or maybe 90s, it was not believed to be electromagnetic fields. It was just believed to be some nut thinking that there's a line that runs here. And that nut was usually a dowser who could feel it. But then after the magnetometers were available to people, and now they're actually pretty cheap, now you can measure the electromagnetic field on the line and away from the line. So it is electromagnetic. But I think when he was talking about the Earth energy and fingers of stone, he was talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the ancients had a science around electromagnetic fields? I think the Maya definitely did, and some of the people that lived in the Americas, North America, our United States. But do you have a feeling that there was a science that they were able to actually develop an understanding of how to manipulate and use these energy fields?
The Egyptians had a battery, if you recall. I believe the Mayans invented a battery. And I don't know that they associated electricity with these fields. I think in those days, the American Indian, in those days, it was, you felt it, you sensed it. It was like feeling the wind on you, but much less powerful. And as long as you went this direction, you felt that feeling the wind on you or whatever it was feeling, you were with it. One of the things that makes this not only plausible but believable is that there are two organs in the body that generate electricity, and anything that generates electricity creates its own magnetic field. That's the heart and the brain. And every magnetic field affects every other magnetic field that's next to. And so if we had in our, for example, the pineal gland received magnetic fields and our brain's own magnetic field, we would have a sense. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we would have a sense of whatever that mysterious line was, we would feel it. And we, back in those days, we wouldn't know it was a magnetic field. Like I said, up to the 80s or 90s, nobody knew it was a magnetic field either. But anyway,
so much of the book you've written, Otherworld, Ancient Evidence of Parallel Universes, is based on the Earth's natural occurring geomagnetic fields. And it occurs to me that there is probably civilizations that we don't know about that actually utilized these fields. I mean, Edgar Cayce talks about the Atlanteans using piezoelectric energy, which is from quartz crystal.
Yeah,
he didn't call it piezoelectric, but it's come to be known to exist as piezoelectric. And there's various theories that other cultures, the Maya, which are one that I studied, used quartz crystals to manipulate natural occurring fields. So
right.
I put it to you, if your thinking is that these parallel universes may have been something that ancient man understood and maybe pass through in and out, and maybe today it's something that we've lost, and you have a whole section on UFOs. Maybe these UFOs are going through different universes and coming
absolutely
out.
I believe that completely. The distance, if you travel straight distance, you know, in space, it's just too far. And if you assume the speed of light is the fastest you can go, and I know that there are warps and wormholes and all kinds of theories, but all of those are just theories. And at this moment in time, the speed of light is the limit. And it's just unthinkable to me that any intelligent race would want to travel that long and that far when, in fact, you can, if you can manipulate these dimensional fields, these electromagnetic fields that open and close dimensions, it would be just a step across to go instantly from one to the other. Probably one of the most famous, or maybe, I don't know if he's the most famous, but he certainly has the most casework studies in UFO sightings, is a man named Jacques Vallée, who actually is in Silicon Valley now, and he's the vice president for electronic companies and joint venture groups, venture capital groups. He wrote several books on UFOs, and he studied over 14,000 cases at the time. And the last book I read from him, called Dimension, is he changed from thinking that these were visitors from other planets to they were visitors from other dimensions. And he uses several hundred cases of similar appearances and disappearances of how these things seem to come and go so quickly. And they would come and go in the air because they would not want to appear inside the Earth's mantle, which would not be healthy for anybody. Anyway, so I'm quite convinced that UFOs, whoever is flying them or piloting them, are from other dimensions. My book, Alien, this is interesting because this affected my life, doing this research. Otherworld was my first book. And Alien Agenda takes much of the research that's in Otherworld about magnetic fields and piloting between dimensions, and that's what it's about. And then the book Long Claws, which is a novel, is the story of otherworld creatures that come through, a family of them come through into deep southern pine forest and wreak havoc with, you know, the people that live around there. But it uses the Indian lore and the ley lines and all of that. So, a number of my books and other research things I'm doing draw on the power behind this information.
Mm-hmm. So is it your belief that this is a phenomenon that we should pay more attention to? Because to my mind, it seems like our ancestors understood these natural occurring energy fields and were able to use them. But we've lost that ability. We've lost the, except for a very few of us, have lost the ability to really sense these energy fields.
Yeah. Well, I've known people who have done this that if you want to feel these fields, you want to build your ability, you should learn how to douse and practice dowsing. And you should learn how to use crystals for your energy field to interact with their energy field and practice it. It's just like anything else in the world. If I learn how to douse and then I don't douse, my ability is not going to increase. when you exercise certain aspects of your brain, that part of your brain physically grows. It develops more brain cells. Now, do I sound crazy now? No, it really does. I mean, there are all kinds of medical one of them is a horrible study. It was an English study. But what they did was there are some very specific areas of your brain that govern you moving your left hand or your right hand. And so the doctors took all these right-handed monkeys and cut their arms off, their right arms off. And then the monkeys used to learn to use their left hands and obviously couldn't use their right hands. And then when they did the autopsies, the part that controlled the left side had become bigger than the part that controlled the right side, which had grown smaller of the brain. So literally, when you practice something, the part of your brain that allows that practice, that controls it, increases in strength. And if you don't believe me, you can read the Dalai Lama, because he's the one that told me that.
Wow. Hey, well, the book is Other Worlds. Our guest today has been Steve Peek, and fascinating research. And I think you really tapped on something. I'm going to get in there and really read your energetics, because it's a fascination of mine. I think that there's a big part of our ancient past that is associated
I just want to say this, and before we close, once you get into the back third of the book, you are going to read myths from Celtic myths and American Indian myths that are going to blow your mind. I won't say any more because it's a whole other show just talking about those. But that, to me, is the first part of the book is building up what happened, what causes, how is it possible. And then the last part of the book is here are examples of this affecting people's lives.
Fascinating. Steve's books are available on Amazon. I've seen them. They are e-books, so they're very, very reasonable. And you can download them immediately and read them. And Steve, it's been a pleasure. It sounds like you're continually researching for your next book. Or do you have something coming out you can tell us about?
I have a sequel to I'm working on. I don't know when it'll be finished. A sequel to the Alien Agenda book.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure, and I think we got a lot out of this. And you leave a lot of questions about our ancient past and what our ancestors understood about our Earth that we.
Well, I'm so very flattered you would have me on your show.
It was a pleasure. It was a great pleasure.
Right.
So that's our show today, and I want to remind you to always go to Earth Ancients on Facebook, Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past, and keep an eye on what is posted there. We have regular daily posts of all things known and unknown about our planet. Next week's guest is Frank Joseph, who has a brand new book called Atlantis and the Coming Ice Age that is just a mind blower. Looking forward to having Frank on the program. So have a great day. Thanks for joining me.